Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Solera Report for our third quarter equity overview. We are recording this on November 6th, the week before we publish November 3rd, so we're going to be talking about the market as of today. And our topic is the investor's perspective, the shift to Global 3.0. I did an annual report and talked about this idea of moving into a very different kind of economy. And we talked about it on the annual wrap-ups. We've talked about it on the quarterly wrap-up. And Chuck Gibson sat down with me and he said, and we've gotten a lot of questions, let's sit down and look at this. What does this mean? If you're an investor, what does it mean to your strategy? How do you see these changes in the equity markets? And so we decided we would do something called the Shift to Global 3.0. And then when the outline got too long, I agreed that in the third quarter wrap-up, which is already at your resource center, I would go through all the different trends that Chuck and I wanted to talk about. So we kind of pre-engineered the trends into the wrap-up, and we'll be using the link to the comic book for the wrap-up to talk about the trends portion today. So this is going to be a very meaty one. Chuck is, as usual, prepared a lot of great slides and a lot of great material. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So Chuck Gibson, you're fresh back from from holiday. I'm so jealous. And so yeah. You're raring to go, right?
I am raring to go, but, you know, I'm a little bit calmer than I am normally. So if the listeners have any question on if there's something wrong with me, they'll understand why.
It was you were on the beach.
Yeah, let's just say I was on the beach and relaxing.
Okay, so let me just quickly go through the outline. We're first going to talk about an update on the markets for the last quarter since our last equity overview. Then we're going to talk through the trends. Then we're going to talk a little bit about risks and bring it all down in the fourth section to strategies. What does this mean to your investment strategy? So let's dive in. Update us on the equity market since the last equity overview. What's been going on for the last 3 months?
Okay, before we jump in, I just want to say that just to make sure everybody understands that the charts that we're presenting today are as of today. They don't include just through the third quarter. So
right.
We've had some major movement that happened from the end of the third quarter until now, and I think that, you know, what I have to say would be different if we were talking just at the end of the third quarter.
Right.
So let's jump into the first chart, which is the S&P 500. And the one thing that happened that was a major shot across the bow, I think, for technicians or, you know, that are really monitoring and following the market is that we had a major break in some technical indicators that presented a warning flag. And let's, you know, I'm a cautious individual in general, but these were major technical damage that we really couldn't ignore. So let's look at the S&P chart and I'll see if I can illustrate what happened. One thing is you can see that this is approximately a 2.5 year chart. And what you have is higher highs and higher lows. And those higher highs are defined by those little blue bars that you can see that each successive peak on the S&P has been higher than the past one. In addition, you can see there's a blue upper trend line that the higher lows that have been created have been able to stay within that trend line. So we've had a very, very nice trend line, trend of stocks that has followed for approximately 2.5 years. And as you can see, what happened at the end of September was we had one, a breach of the trend line. In addition, within a week or two later, we had created a new lower low. And on top of that, we crossed over the 200-day moving average. Now, there's nothing overly significant about a 200-day moving average other than, you know, that's what technicians use as a broad-based look across a 1 year's worth of movement in the S&P. So when you break that, that's a warning flag. So we had three things that happened. We created a lower low. We breached an upper trend line, and we crossed the 200-day moving average. And so that created what concerned me the most is that this was a potential. We didn't know it, and we've just now gotten confirmation this week. We didn't know it, but this was a potential and change in direction. And that's right. What we're looking for. As trend followers, you want to be in a trend as long as the trend is in your favor. And when the trend changes, you want to get out. So this was the warning flag that the trend might be over. And lo and behold, we didn't have this data at the end of the quarter. Lo and behold, as of this last week, we've made all-time new highs. So it was just a warning flag that is no longer valid, and we have to start all over again.
So okay, now let me ask you, though. A lot of times when you get a correction, someone will talk about the legs down.
Yep.
And you and I were recently talking about, are we going to get two or three legs down? Now that we've made a new high, can we still get that third leg down?
Oh, sure. But it'll start of a new trend down. I mean, it'll start of a new downward leg. So
right.
Since we've gotten a new high, that last movement down has been basically wiped out. You can ignore it.
Okay.
Now, the one thing I do want
to... So my looking for a sale... You know me, I'm always looking for a sale.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing I do want to point out is that, and I don't have it really well illustrated, I was trying to figure a way to do it and so that I could reflect it, but look at the distance between each successive peak, from the distance from the peak to the upper blue trend line. And if it isn't obvious, what you should see is that that distance keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right.
And that shows you what you have is waning momentum. And that's another warning flag that we have to be worried about. Now, this could all be obliterated if we break out to – we have broken out to all-time highs. If we keep going and we the strength continues, then we start all over again and we look for new low.
Right.
So that is it for S&P. Let's move on to the institutional index. And there's really nothing surprising here. This is exactly the same thing that happened to the S&P. And again, a breach of a trend line. We had a new lower low created. And while I don't have it, it did also breach the 200-day moving average. So both of these indexes are the ones that we follow very closely, were concerning. And as of this last week, we've breached to all-time highs and the trend continues.
Right.
The one thing I will illustrate, though, is that correction that we had on both the S&P and the institutional index during that period of time was, depends upon which one, it was almost double digits. I think it was somewhere between 9 and 10%. And it was completely, you know, you tend to go down very, very fast, and then you tend to go up much slower. And what happened was is we went up just as fast as we went down. And that is...
Which was very unusual.
Yes, that's an anomaly. So I'm not sure how to interpret it. Normally, you tend to go up slower in that because you don't have that much strength. So I'm not sure I'm going to draw any conclusion to that other than I just wanted to point it out because the strength of the market continues. Even though, you know, everybody's saying that the, you know, stocks are too high, something's pushing them higher.
Right.
All right, let's take a look at a little bit closer refinement of the S&P and look at what sectors did well for the quarter. Again, this is not just the quarter, so this actually includes through October. And what we saw was strength in healthcare and financials, consumer staples, and technology all had gains along with utilities. But the things that got really pummeled the hardest were materials and energy. And, you know, the one thing I'm not saying that this is deflationary, but what you see in a deflationary environment first is when you start to see commodities start to take a much bigger hit than stocks. And when you start to see a rush into the dollar, this seems like an early potential start of a deflationary event. When I say event, it's
right.
A correction. So just raising the flag, not saying that that's what it is, but I am saying that this is what you look for in an early part of a deflationary move.
Right.
And let's take a look at U.S. Treasuries.
The surprise of the year.
Exactly. We had, you know, this is an interesting chart because we all heard the death of the dollar and the death of interest rates. Interest rates can only go higher. As of January, you know, we saw this pattern set up, and we had a price objective for this move to higher bond prices, lower interest rates. Everybody said it wasn't going to happen. It did. Not only has it, you know, met our price objective, it's actually gone higher. And frankly, it's not showing any weakness at this point in time. And
right.
this to me is not only, as you said, a very interesting chart, but it's telling us something else. And I think that we have to respect the trend in this one, and I expect bond prices to continue to move higher.
Right. Now, we should underscore this is the long bond.
Oh, so, yes.
Right. So the numbers are far less spectacular at the short end. But as you said, I think, and I want to talk about this when we talk further about the U.S. dollar, you know, the possibilities are very real that this could go much higher.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. And speaking of the U.S. dollar, that's two more charts away. Let's go beyond this bond chart and head on to commodities. Chart number five. And this, I think, is interesting because we had this downtrend where commodities broke out in January, about the same time that the bonds broke out. And we had a nice rally up. And you can see it had about a 10 to 15% rise from that breakout. And then all of a sudden it started to curl and reversed. And it's not only gone past the point at which it started on the breakout, but it's gone down even further. And this just helps illustrate my concern that I brought up about deflation. You know, this index, unfortunately, has, you know, is mostly weighted by oil and energy, so it's gonna look like this. But if I pulled up the components of this, which includes agriculturals and other non-energy related commodities, they've all been in a severe downtrend.
It's amazing because, you know, we got to the end of 2011 and thought, well, you know, this year we're going to get an opportunity in commodities because look how far they've come down. And then we went all through 12 and we got to the end of the year and we thought, well, this year we ought to get an opportunity in commodities because look how far they've come down. And then 2013, again, falling. And you and I started this year and we thought, you know, we ought to get an opportunity in commodities. And, you know, they started to perk up and then boom. So you almost wonder, you know, I don't know when the bear is over, but I am loath, Chuck, to say that we are looking forward to an opportunity over the next year in commodities.
Yeah, we are consistent. You know, the interesting thing is for me is that commodities move inversely to interest rates, right? So they move inversely to the bond prices, excuse me.
Right.
And so we're all thinking, you know, they printed so much money, even though they, you know, they say they're going to stop this thing, they've got so much liquidity sloshing in the system, at some point in time, we're going to start to see a rise in interest rates. And when those interest rates rise, that's going to present an opportunity for commodities. And what did we see? Just the exact thing happened, or just the exact opposite thing happened, where interest rates started to fall, commodities started to rally at the same time interest rates started to fall. And that was something that we were scratching our heads with. We're saying something isn't right here. And lo and behold, interest rates continue to fall, and commodities said, oh, you know, the bond market is right this time, and we're going to reverse and go back down below where we started.
Right. So this isn't just another sign flashing deflation. And and it's also something else that's supporting earnings, corporate earnings in many different areas, because as the price of coffee, sugar, and milk goes down, Starbucks is in a better position.
Yes. Absolutely. And so the question for me is that, you know, why did we see this? And let's go to the chart number six. And this is to me was the cause of so much of the movement in the price of, you know, other instruments. And that was the breakout in the U.S. dollar. This has been, this chart goes back since 2003. And we had this downtrend line of the dollar and we broke out in June, I think it was June or July, and we had a back test. It broke out, back test, and then a move higher. And I have to say that I was skeptical. You know, I was skeptical when it started. But if you look at the strength of this move, if you look at the pattern from which it has come from, this, from a technician standpoint, I don't like to predict the future, and I'm not, but I'm telling you that this pattern says it could go a lot higher.
Right. Well, this is a point of great concern to me because I do think it's possible over the next year and a half that we see the dollar much, much higher. I think that's a reasonable scenario. You've got companies and countries all around the world that have borrowed in the dollar, and now we're going into a deflationary period, and it's literally a bear trap and could drive the dollar higher. And I don't mean to predict that that's going to happen, because there are a lot of different scenarios that could happen, but that's certainly one of them. And for some reason, the more the dollar rises and the stronger it looks, the more you start to see all sorts of commentators in from a variety of different worlds pushing the idea that the global currency system is about to collapse, the dollar is about to be reset to a gold standard. You know, the end of the world is, it's, there are various variations of the same theme, but the more the dollar rises, the more you see these kind of hucksters out there pushing these lines. And I'm really worried that, you know, that our readers and subscribers are going to fall prey to some of this stuff when in fact prices are going in the opposite direction.
Well, you know me, my response to that is always going to be, all you got to do is look at price. And if price is telling you that it's going to continue to go higher, how can you fight that? It does, you know, what you have to do is look at what reality is. And the fact of the matter is that while we may have concerns about our currency and what's being done to it, we're in a heck of a lot better shape than most other, in fact, I would consider all other currencies. And as such, it is a safe haven in any other countries or any other currency, people that hold those, they're looking for opportunities to be able to secure their future. If you look at Europe, Europe's stock market has been terrible. And right. If those, what you have, if you're a European investor and you've got money, you've got to, one, diversify yourself out of the euro, and two, where are you going to go? You're going to go to strength. And that's what good investors do. They follow strength, and strength has been in the U.S. stock market and the U.S. dollar. And so all that does is that strength begets more strength because it pulls in outside money that is going to potentially drive this much higher.
Right. Well, part of it is you have many countries around the world who are trying to protect their export market. And so they're well served to have their currencies fall.
Yep.
So a little bit of this is a race to the bottom. And, you know, there's no doubt about it that fiat currencies are being debased all around the world. And, you know, but it's far from just the dollar. There was a great piece the other day that pointed out what the global debt ratio was for all governments before 2008 and what it is now. Uh-huh. And, you know, the reality is the way everybody can handle paying their debts is to debase the currency some more. So here we are. But I just think we all need to be prepared for the possibility of a much stronger dollar over the next year, year and a half. Because it could absolutely happen, and certainly the last couple months have shown what that feels like.
Yeah, and I would be real cautious about doing, you know, fighting that trend, because the trend, again, if you're an investor, you want to follow a trend, and the trend is clearly up. And so if there's any doubts, just take a look at the price of the U.S. dollar and how it compares to the other currencies, and that will tell you right away.
Right. Okay. One of the, we didn't look at the charts of the emerging markets, but it's funny because I'm teasing you about the commodities. I keep saying, when can we buy emerging markets? And it's the same problem because the PEs are so much more attractive in the emerging markets. The problem is with commodities down and the dollar rising, now's not the time. So
no,
same struggle.
We've tried that. We saw a breakout in the emerging markets earlier this year, and here we were jumping on the bandwagon saying that this is a potential new trend, and the trend, it started and it quickly reversed, and the dollar took hold, you know, dollar strength took hold and drove not only the emerging markets, but it helped drive Europe and commodities down to new levels. And as long as the dollar is continuing to move higher, I think investors need to be really, really cautious about
right.
anything that's non-dollar denominated.
Right. No, that's clearly the case. Okay, so let's turn to the trends. So the shift to global 3.0. What we did, ladies and gentlemen, is Chuck and I sat down and tried to break the shift to global 3.0 down into different areas. And as I said before, I decided to make life easier to go through the trends and describe them in the third quarter wrap up and post a comic book with different pictures and descriptions to make it easy. And what I want to do today is go through those trends and talk about them, not in the context of so much of what's happening, which we've already done, but let's look at how that looks from the point of view of investors and equity. So I want you to be able to see these trends as they evidence themselves in the equity markets. So, of course, the first is my old favorite, the rebalancing of the global economy. And this is one I've spent a lot of time on this in the last year because we had Steve Roach on with his wonderful book, Unbalanced, The Codependency of America and China, about the sort of next phase in the sort of the relationship and integration of the Chinese and American economy. But let's talk about rebalancing the global economy. How, Chuck, how do you see this in terms of, if you look at the stock market, how does this show up from your point of view?
Well, I think that this rebalancing, one, I think it's going to take a while, and I think people need to understand that what we're going to see is transpiring, but it's going to take a whole lot of effort and time to be able to get there. And my biggest concern is that while we identify potential trends going forward, that they're not going to happen overnight.
Well, this is a long one because in my mind, it started many decades ago, but it really got going with the creation of the World Trade Organization and big shifts of capital out in the 90s and the development of the emerging markets. And to me, this is a 50-year process. This is a very long-term process.
Yes.
The second trend we have is transforming to 3.0 finance and investment. And part of this process is really the creation of stock markets and equity markets around the world. One of the things I pointed out was that in 1990, at the beginning of the 1990s, there was $9 trillion of global equity market capitalization traded on world exchanges. And as of June this year, it was $69 trillion. So that's a big increase because we're literally going through a process, and this will only happen once, where, you know, the global economy is coming into the equity markets. And you're beginning to see access to all sorts of investments that, you know, didn't exist 5, 10, 15 years ago. So this is very new and very big and, as you said, very long-lived.
Yeah. Catherine, I've got a question. You know, I've always wondered, how long do you think that this can go on? I mean, that is a huge expansion, as you said, from 9 to 60, whatever. Could this be $100 trillion? And if so, how long do you think it would take? Because that's a huge rate.
See, I think it's going to be – I think it's only begun. Okay. So I think $69 trillion is tiny compared to where it's going to go. And I think it's going to – it's – here's the thing. The process takes generations. So don't think in terms of – you know, because you're talking about people learning. It's an educational process. How long does it take for a society like China? I'll never forget, you know, when I was in China in the 90s, they didn't have a managerial infrastructure. And if you look at what they're grappling with now, they're really trying to grapple with creating corporations that can compete on the international markets. And they don't have the accounting. They don't have the standards. They don't have the managerial infrastructure and technology, because you need that deep inside the culture. You need it deep inside the education, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so you need two or three generations of law firms and accounting firms and all these kinds of technologies, but it needs to be embedded deep in the culture. So to me, it's going to take about four generations at a minimum where a society or an economy or a country is really committed to doing this. And if you look at the total amount of corporate assets, business assets, or real estate outstanding, you know, it's many, many multiples of what's reflected on the equity markets. So I think this is tiny. As you know, one of the things I'm very interested in is what are the governmental policies going to be in terms of investing in bonds versus equity? Because as we've had governments issue more and more and more debt, you've watched the governmentally controlled or influenced pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and various governmental institutions buy bonds. Now we're seeing a shift where it appears they're pushing into equity. You know, Chuck, if they decide to shift into equity as we're securitizing more and more, you know, then we're talking about the $69 trillion being many multiples, many, many multiples. But that's, you know, two or three generations from now. Remember, the young investors coming up are the first investors who can literally, you know, click open their mobile phone and decide to invest in any stock market around the world.
Yeah.
That's new. And to them, they don't know anything different. So how many generations do you need of global generations who think in those terms?
Yeah, the internet's really changed that, and I think it's going to rapidly increase, you know, the pace at which we've gone up to this point in time. So let me ask you a question, because you alluded to it. There, you know, you talked about China. You didn't say much about the emerging markets. I'm guessing that you think that the majority of this, or I won't guess, do you think the majority of this new expansion, this new securitization will come outside of the United States?
Yes, I do.
And the developed.
Although, here's what's very interesting. The opportunity in the United States is if you decide to create place-based ways of securitizing places. So if you do, you know, place-based REITs, there's tremendous opportunity to securitize a lot more in the United States, but you're going to have a major conceptual breakthrough on sort of trading places. And I don't see any move to do that. I mean, it's theoretically possible. But for now, I think the sort of the easy securitization is going to come globally around the world, both real estate and corporations securitizing.
Okay.
And it's going to be the frontier markets too. So we didn't mention it, but one of the markets that's held up very well, the emerging markets haven't been strong, but the frontier markets have been very strong.
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, the liquidity isn't quite there as much as you'd like to, but as you said, you know, at some point in time, with the ability of the internet and the, you know, investors can just get on their mobile phone and invest anywhere across the world, you know that that's coming, and you know that we're going to be talking about, you know, Mongolia and other countries that we wouldn't normally,
right,
like we do China and maybe, you know, the other emerging markets.
Well, what's amazing is even though liquidity is not where we want it to be, particularly for the institutions, the liquidity now in country ETFs, I mean, the ability to invest in a broad index of the market in Singapore or Hong Kong or Thailand, any of these places, it's provided tremendous access that, you know, 5 years ago, the fees and commissions of reaching into those markets was enormous. So the liquidity has improved enormously. It's got a great way to go, but it really, you know, I see the improvement. There was one thing I wanted to mention, and that is a lot of, when you looked at the commodities chart, one thing I would point out is when you started to see commodities fall in 2011, I'm not saying that's the only thing that's going on, but the drops very much parallel the institution of literally getting everybody online. So, you know, one of the themes we're going to talk about is commodities versus technology, because we know there are many forces that should be pushing up the price of commodity, but then there are many forces that are re-engineering that pressure down, technology being one of them. And I always find it's interesting to see the explosion of smartphones at the same time that commodities are crashing and to wonder if there's any connection or not. Okay, so part of it is the securitization. Another part, of course, is the currency. And what is the impact going to be of mobile payment systems and online systems? I don't know if you noticed in the trend chart, we were watching Bitcoin literally surpass PayPal in volume, believe it or not. I kind of struggle with that one.
I didn't realize that.
That's, well, who knows if you can trust the statistics, but it's clear to see that we have a shift of transactions online. And that is absolutely part of this process. And I think the big question on everybody's mind is, what's going to happen as everybody gets online and starts using mobile payment systems? How is currency and payment systems going to work? One of the things I saw when I looked at this for the wrap-up was I realized, I was in the middle of looking at Alibaba's IPO and how Alipay operated relative to PayPal or this new Apple Pay. And one of the things that was clear to me is all of the mobile payment systems are competing for market share now in a global market with 7 billion people. And those 7 billion people can't afford the spreads of the developed world. And so there's a real sort of slapback tsunami coming when an Alibaba shows up and they're catering to people who can't afford the spreads that PayPal is getting here, and how that's going to sort of turn the market. And I noticed when the week that Alibaba did their IPO, PayPal notified Solari on their online store of a pretty significant break in fees and float.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I said, okay, that's the emerging market slapback. Thank you. Anyway, okay, so building, because of the mobile platform and sort of the getting everybody connected is a part of this, the third trend we had was building out the global network. And that's one where I think your background in the information technology and being an engineer has really helped me see what's sort of see this in the equity market. So maybe if you could talk about how that shows up and what's happening in the stock market.
You know, it was interesting because back when I was in the corporate world, we had a guy that was covering AT&T, and that was one of my accounts. I was I managed a major account section for a large semiconductor company. And he came in saying, the world is changing, and the world right now is going to – it's a convergence, and we're going to converge the computer and the telephone, and we're going to converge all of these things, and it's all going to go to a handheld device. And we're just laughing at the guy. And no, we weren't, because, you know, the phones, you were lucky to get, you know, if you'll remember, Get Smart, Maxwell Smart would pull his shoe off and he would talk on his shoe. And that was, it was the size of the phones back then. And what we've seen is this, he was absolutely right. And whether or not AT&T is the driver of this, I don't want to give them that much credit. But it was really interesting to see how that has come to fruition and it's being accepted. And I think we've got a long, long way to go to see what the technology is going to bring to handheld devices. And I think, you know, our world is changing. We're in the middle of this thing. And if, you know, as somebody that's involved in it day to day, I think this is the direction we're in, and we got to accept it, and we might as well get on board and don't fight it.
Well, one of the things I've seen, so when you look at certainly the U.S. market and the sectors that have been strong, what we've seen is we've seen certainly the device companies, so Apple and Samsung, and explosion of companies that are making the various devices, whether it's the tablets or the phones. But then we've also seen an explosion of the cloud services, much more of a commodity service.
Yes.
But you see Amazon, Google, others, you know, backing into this and seeing their part of a critical part of their strategic position is having people in the cloud and having the analytics that make that interesting. And then the one that's fascinated me the most is the explosion of social media and realizing, oh, the arbitrator of all this sort of Internet of Things is the social media platform, whether it's doing, you know, people connecting within a place or within a network or communicating with each other. You know, if you watch the statistics of advertising that's now shifting out of print and TV onto social media, it's quite explosive. And I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't been watching, you know, the stocks and the explosive stock market capitalizations that said to me, okay, I have to take this seriously. Yeah. I didn't want to, but I have to take this seriously because the market is seeing something. And that's when I realized, oh, this is really going to be the switching station for the Internet of Things.
You know, I have to admit, you know, being in the middle of this thing, and I kind of pride myself on being a part of that technological change, I didn't see it coming either. I thought, this is the biggest waste of time that I can have. What is it going to be used for? And all of a sudden, you know, you see Twitter being used for the riots and getting information out and people contacting things and the uses of it. And as you've always commented, it's also a great database for the CIA and and other government institutions that want to know and track everybody else, because everybody seems to want to, you know, give everybody their information. So
the one I found fascinating was the report of Weibo. I have one wonderful client who's over in China, and this idea that the Chinese suddenly can contact everybody around them on Weibo, you know, and it's quite, and if you look at the statistics, I don't know if you noticed the chart I put in under the finance section, but you now have a higher percentage of the population in China using these technologies than in the United States.
No, I didn't know.
They're quite online. The last thing I pointed out in this section of sort of the Internet of Things was your point, Chuck, about the very dramatic developments going on in the interface and making interfaces much more human or much more accessible to humans. So instead of us having to talk to the computer in its language, it will talk to us in our language.
Yeah.
And I think you don't see, well, we're seeing a little bit in the software technology when we look at companies, but I also think that's an area that is just going to explode this whole sector as it happens. Okay, reengineering delivery. This is one I'm very interested in. So the impact on the distribution of these different technologies and how goods and services get delivered. How does that show up in the market?
Well, what I found was interesting was, for me, is that, you know, you still, when you buy something online or you do something online, you still have to have it delivered to you. And you know, the FedExes of the world, this is an old stodgy company that's been around. Who would have thought that they would have done what they've done in the stock market and how well they've done and benefited from Amazon and everybody wanting to not have to go and fight the crowds?
Right. Right.
So the other point. You know, I think from an old school kind of standpoint, looking at the companies that have been around for a while, not the new innovations, I think that they've done, you know, they're going to be a benefactor of what we're seeing.
I always find it fascinating. One of the most fascinating things I find in investing in equities is looking at the companies who are making the shift and the others who aren't. So for example, this week on the blog, they're not publicly traded, they're privately held. I did a little blog post on my favorite catalog, which is the Lehman's Hardware catalog. Lehman's Hardware is a store in Ohio who has traditionally served the Amish. They sell non-electrical goods. So it's very old-timey stuff. And the founder's son got them online and they exploded with, you know, everybody interested in gardening or sustainable living. And so now they are unbelievably have an explosive business all through the internet. You know, and so that's a very old timey company.
Yeah.
That's made the switch to 3.0, like, you know, 3.0, they're doing better in 3.0 than they were in 2.0. You know, so we see companies that are very traditional, like Corning, who I think, you know, have done a great job at sort of developing new products, innovating. You and I can come up with a lot of them. So it's not, you know, you don't have to be Amazon to do well in 3.0 at all.
No.
But some companies, it's almost like they went to sleep and didn't notice. You know, they never used the internet. And so you look at companies like Sears and you think, what happened?
If you use Sears as an example, because I think that's a really good one, you know, because of the pace, and I'll just, you know, being in the midst of this thing for as long as I have, the pace is so fast, it's faster than anything I've ever been involved with. And all it takes is one misstep by management to miss that, and then all of a sudden it's too late. You get run over by everybody else, and you cannot catch up because of, you know, in Sears' case, because of the size of themselves.
Right. Well, in every part of the market, in every sector, you're seeing companies that are smoothly jumping the curve from 2.0 to 3.0 and others that are just getting left flat-footed. And I think one of the things as an investor you have to be aware of is, you know, you're going to see a lot of different shakeouts, and part of that shakeout is deflationary.
Yeah.
As you know, to get back to the deflationary. Okay. Next, as I said, I'm interested in this concept of commodities versus technology, because, you know, technology can be unbelievably deflationary, unbelievably. And one of the things I love about the internet is it's really implementing, you know, when you improve the information technology, then all different sectors improve their communication, not only within the sector, but across sectors. And the story I put up for that section is one I love about three 16-year-old Irish girls who figured out with a completely natural sort of low-tech process how to improve crop yields by 74%. Now, I'm not saying that you could translate that around the world, but imagine if you came up with an innovation that improved crop yields by 74%, you know, on a significant scale. That's very deflationary.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that the internet allows somebody to actually get that out. And before, in the past, you know, how would it get from Ireland over to here other than word of mouth or something? You know, that's
right.
It's just the internet provides you that vehicle to be able to get it out and have people recognize and actually capitalize on it.
Well, I put up in that section, I put up a chart of Apple and Amazon versus gold, corn, oil, and copper. And, you know, you could see you'd much rather have been an Apple than in any of the commodities. Okay, let's jump to energy. Energy is, to me, a fascinating area because we've had such a significant increase in domestic production since 2005. It's quite extraordinary. And as we've just seen prices come down a lot. And we're also seeing the improvement in, it's one of the things you've taught me about, is improvement in the economics of renewables and efforts to adopt renewables, for example, in Europe in a way that have really sort of whacked the utility prices over there. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about what's going on in energy and how we see that in the market.
You know, what I thought was interesting was that if you look at the economic cycle, and I didn't bring this up in the first section I was going to, but if you look at the economic cycle and where we are in this business cycle, you would expect energy to be a leader, not a laggard. Because if you remember, energy was the big loser for the quarter.
Right.
And was that because it got overextended, or was that because we have growing output in the United States, which is driving oil prices down and making everybody, you know, we're having a major oversupply, and that oversupply is actually going to benefit more people because of the lower prices. Now, it's not going to benefit necessarily the energy sector, but what it will do is it will provide you and I the ability to spend less money and have more money to, I don't know, buy healthcare because it's going to cost us more.
Right.
But the other thing is that the one disruptor it has is that because the other sectors within the energy sector, so if you look at hydro or you look at wind or you look at solar or geothermal or any of those renewables, they become cost ineffective or less cost effective, we'll say that. So, you know, before as oil continued to go higher, what we would see is that they become more cost effective, and so therefore you would have a much broader mix of energy sources. But as oil and energy if you use oil as the baseline, if it continues to drop and it stays where we're at now, these other things become a lot less attractive. So if you're an investor, these people are going to have a much more difficult time making profits on the energy, on a cost per energy basis on these other non-oil based solutions.
Well, historically, we've seen that a lot. We've seen, you know, as prices rise, suddenly tremendous interest in renewables. Then as people start to invest in renewables, wow.
Yes.
It flies down again. It's quite remarkable how that happens.
We talked about solar, and, you know, again, that was one of the things I love to follow. And solar, as energy got up, or oil got up in the $90 to $100 per barrel cost, in the increase in technology that we're seeing in solar, there's a crossover that's expected to happen. Now, that was more towards the second half of this decade, but because of the improvements that we've seen in technology, it's more like a year or two away, which, you know, of course, that was at prices when we were at $90
right.
a barrel. There was a crossover in which solar became as competitive. And so, you know, I think that this is something you can't discount. If you look at that little in your graph there, if you look at how little is being used in solar, the potential, if the governments don't get involved, because as you said, it's been a real disruptor for the utilities, that could be a game changer. It really could.
Right. Right. Well, what I see is over the next 10 years, there's tremendous potential for disruption in the energy world.
Yep.
And so I think you just have to be ready to, you know, to rock and roll. There's no way to know what's going to happen. And it could be pretty, you know, it could be pretty wild.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that you don't want to buy and hold necessarily.
I think you want to buy and monitor. But, you know, it's very hard to monitor. This is one where I tend to want experts following it for me. Uh-huh. I don't want to have to monitor myself because, you know, so for example, when the Russians came out and said they had a new hybrid fusion, and 24 hours later, Lockheed Martin comes out and says, well, they'll have something in 10 years or five. And,
yes.
You know, so what do? I call you and I say, Chuck, what does this really mean? You know, because I don't know.
Yeah.
It, you know, what does this really mean? It's hard to tell. Okay. Education. Education is one that, you know, I'm not used to, or I wasn't used to having turn up in the equity markets until we started to look at some of the equity stocks in the emerging markets, or the education stocks companies in the emerging market, although we have a few publicly traded here. But I noted in the trend that the second largest download category for apps at the Apple Store was education. It was pretty interesting. So what's your take on education and how it turns up in the equity markets?
You know, because of the credentials that I have, I'm forced to do a lot of additional education. And so I'm in favor, and there wasn't much of it before, in favor of doing online. Because, you know, if I want to study at 12 o'clock at night, I don't want to have to force to drive to a classroom. And I find that this potential, you know, I don't think I'm in line with the younger generations, but I find that the younger generations would much rather do it online than they would necessarily in a classroom. And so I think that there's huge potential as a disruptor for online education, and I don't know where it's going to go. What we saw was a number of online companies like Corinthian Colleges come to mind and a couple of other that, you know, just went crazy in the equity market and then they flamed out.
Right.
So, you know, maybe this is a purge of the system and we're going to, you know, you start off with a whole bunch of people and you get it down to a manageable few. But I think that this is going to be a huge growth area personally.
Well, my take on it is, you know, I've been trying to figure out what can explain Common Core. And I think there's a tremendous desire coming sort of top down to make this a corporate endeavor. And I basically think the whole plan is nuts because it doesn't, I just don't see this as something that, you know, education is a much more bottom up, pretty yeasty thing. So I'm very nervous and hesitant about most sort of publicly traded education things.
Yeah.
But what fascinated me when I looked at this, because to me, education is the most important factor in sort of regional or a country's competitiveness. I just think you can't put too much stress on education. What really struck me, Chuck, when I went through this is if you look at the online opportunities in education, so great universities putting their curriculum online, or the Khan Academy, or different entrepreneurs doing educational websites, or people doing apps and software, things that are easily downloaded. What I finally realized was, wait a minute, you can have a group of kids in a remote village in Outer Mongolia, and if they have a teacher who cares about them and they have internet access, they have access to the most fantastic resources around the world at very low price, and they can learn as fast as they want. I'm always recommending a DVD on a school in Russia where kids just, incredible education. But globally, everybody can have access to this. And meantime, American kids have a handicap of about 25,000 hours of wasteful requirements, whether it's, the curriculum or student loans. And I just don't think you can, if you look at the market economics of those kids being free to just learn what they need to be unbelievably competitive versus kids loaded down without handicaps, I think the slapback from the emerging and the frontier markets in education is going to be incredible. I don't even know how to, imagine what it might be, but I can't imagine some kids having access to all the greatest curriculum in the world and being free to do whatever they want versus some kids loaded down with these wasteful handicaps. So I think this is going to be wild. Anyway,
well, I will say this is, I know somebody's going to get it right. I don't know who it is, and it may be too early, but when somebody does get it right, that's the rewards are going to be really limitless. I just,
right. If Alibaba figures this out, Amazon's really in trouble.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the next one is war, the biggest business. And I just have to laugh because I don't know if you ever read Richard Mayberry, but Richard Mayberry just says, take half your money and put it in Lockheed Martin and the other half and put it in long treasuries and you'll be great. And I hate to say it, he's been right so far.
Yeah. Anyway. Unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at those companies that provide those services and to support the war machine are, they're pretty much a lock in profitability, and that's how they work. You're not going to kill it. You're not going to hit home runs, but you're definitely not going to lose a whole lot either.
Well, I want nothing to do with them, but it's going to work until it doesn't. So there you go.
I will say this is, I don't know if you remember, because I was in the middle of it, but when Clinton was elected and we started to back off on, the amount of money that we were putting into these companies and the war effort, it was amazing what happened to those stocks during that period of time. So while we haven't seen that since Clinton, it's possible somebody else could eventually get elected that may have the same impact. So
if you look at the comic book, I show the Lockheed Martin, I'm picking on Lockheed, so apologies to the guys at Lockheed. They're just the largest one. But if you look at Lockheed versus S&P, what you see is, they're way outperforming, and then in 2000 they come back down, and then 2001 happens, and we're off to the races. And and they've outperformed ever since. Okay, space, the final frontier. Great hoopla, and interest in space. I put up some of the different articles. We saw a group of one of the Japanese semiconductors coming out and saying, well, this market's mature. We're gonna focus on space. But certainly a lot of hoopla. But I put up this story that I love that Warren Buffett always tells, that investors from the beginning of the Wright brothers' flight have net lost money. So my question on space is, this is an opportunity to just lose more money, or are we finally going to turn a profit?
Personally, I know this is what you really love, and I don't know if the readers, listeners knew this, but my prior job before I started as an investment advisor, I was a director of the space division of a semiconductor company, and frankly, I don't see how, because, you know, there's the amount of people that can actually afford or that they're going to address are going to be really small, but I don't think space is the striving and the movement towards space is going to change. So if you're going to make money in there, my point is you look for companies that provide the services or the components that people need to go into space. And that's what we did as a semiconductor company. Real briefly, what it was is that when you're in space, you have a lot of radiation that you have to protect against, because anytime you have electronics, those are affected by that radiation. It's just normal,
right,
part of the atmosphere. And so what we did was we made radiation-hardened semiconductors. And so regardless of whether or not this was, you know, military-based or whether it was commercial or anything else, you still need to have those services. So if you're going to look, if you're going to make money in that environment, that's where I would be focusing, because whether space grows or not, we still know that there's going to be the demand for those kind of components.
All right, well, here's what I think. I think space is becoming more important for a couple reasons. One is, as you move more and more of the financial system onto the mobile platform and the Internet of Things, the satellite systems become that more important.
Yep.
So what you're really looking at is not so much, you know, trips to Mars. You're talking about satellites,
yep,
that are basically communication networks for what's going on down here on Earth.
Or spy.
And that's...
Yes.
Well, it's not all a spy network, but it's
no.
you're basically running the internet. A big portion of the internet is running through space.
Yep.
Yeah. So to me, that's, you know, that's part of it. The other thing I find very interesting, and it, one of my theories is that if you look at what is happening to develop the manufacturing domestically in the it's North America and the developed world, I think a lot of what is being organized to be done in space, they want the manufacturing closer to home. And so it's part of rebuilding the industrial base in the developed world. And so if we are getting a manufacturing renaissance, you know, space is a piece of helping that happen.
You know, this is a real quick sidelight. The interesting thing about manufacturing is that some of the things that you can do in space from a manufacturing standpoint, you can't do on Earth, because
right,
certain components don't combine. And those type of reactions, you know, you can get unbelievable yields. You can do some things that you can't do on here on Earth. And that can give you a huge competitive advantage if they can get the space program up and running. You know, you would have a manufacturing lab up in space.
Right. Right. So it's, I think they call that suborbital platform manufacturing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm really encouraged about what can happen in space. And, but I think it's going to be a government funded and defense contractor.
Yeah.
Area. And you're right. Where the investor is going to see it is, you know, investing in the industrial platforms that get volume from that.
Yep.
Okay, transportation and infrastructure. This is something where I would love to see. Who is it? The IMF came out and said we need a global, you know, massive increase in global infrastructure spending. And I said, yes, what a good idea. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, though. And but let's talk about infrastructure and transportation. Where have we been seeing this in the equity markets?
Well, you know, I think that there's no question that, you know, I don't know if I want to recommend some companies, because it's not really recommending, but we see a lot of companies that are just focusing on this. You know, the few that I'm talking about, there's the Teslas of the world. There's those companies that are going to have to, you know, transportation, human transportation is not going to get away from the automobile anytime soon. It's kind of like moving away from oil. So what they're trying to do is make them a lot smarter and a lot safer. And that's all done through electronics. You could see, if you look at, again, I was involved in electronics in the automotive world, and the amount of computers that are on a car today is unbelievable. And those
computers
are now, before they were just computing and giving information about the car. Now it's gone way beyond that. It's talking about giving information about the people next to you, the car, how far the police are away. You know, the abilities for these cars to be able to, or transportation to do things that they haven't in the past is just going to blow people away. What changes we're seeing.
Somebody called me today. They were in their brand new Honda and they were saying, oh, the car does this and that and talks to me. And this quite, but I see an unbelievable, I put up the Popular Science cover to the article they did on called The Future of the Car. And the competition among car makers to, you know, to integrate technology and sort of, and I think part of it is if you look at the studies that show how many cities in the world are going to be mega cities, that is 10 million people or more, we're watching as the emerging markets develop, you're watching the development of the middle class. And as a middle class grows of people who can afford cars, there's nothing worse than 10 million people in one place, all who just bought a car. That is a nightmare. Yeah. So I think, you know, the planning board in the sky is saying, okay, we can't possibly have 10 million people in all these different megacities buying cars and doing it the way we're doing it now. How do we do it? So the idea is lighter, smaller, smarter. And, you know, we're seeing all these different ideas of how about share cars and do other things to make this a much more environmentally pleasant experience. So what I want to know, though, are we going to have cars that run on water? That's what I want to know.
Well, we have those engines that run on air right now, so you can expect to some. I'll just tell you a quick side story. A friend of mine who is very, very intelligent, he's a director of design for semiconductors, and he bought a new car. I won't name the kind of car. He had to take a one-day class on how to manage the car. When I say manage it, I'm not talking about keeping it up to date. I'm talking about being able to communicate with the electronics within his cockpit.
Right. I can believe it because, you know, now I got a new car in 2012, which is, you know, a Luddite compared to what's available now. And I just said, you know, I have to take a day and read this manual. And it's unbelievably complicated. There are still functions, I confess to you, that I do not know how to use.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, my favorite railroads, I just have to bring up.
Yes. I'll let you go into this because, you know, this is one of those, when you originally brought it up to me, I'm thinking, is this beta or VHS? I'm thinking, you know, we're talking about 1980s technology here. And sure enough, you know, this is the Warren Buffett way of, you know, the railways are providing the transportation to get stuff, the manufacturing.
Yeah, they're I think trains are going to be the workhorses of 3.0.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've certainly seen the trains and transportation do well in the markets. Yep. Another thing I wanted to mention, I took a pretty serious look about a year ago at air transportation. And what we were seeing is that as the emerging markets, as the middle class grows, and it's really business travel that's driving it, pretty significant increase in air traffic, particularly in the business and sort of upper end areas. So that's happening as well. Okay.
Technology is driving a lot of that because of, if you look at the improvements that they're making in the aircraft themselves, the cost to transport somebody from, you know, say Brazil to the United States has come down dramatically, not just because of the efficiencies of the engines, but and because of the size and the amount of people that they can carry in a plane comfortably. It's going to be, that will continue to improve, and I think that's just going to enhance and not go away anytime soon. So I think there's going to be a huge, with
right,
the population growing like it is, you would expect to see this, you know, be a benefactor from that.
Right. That's why I'd love to see some of the new materials they're working with really come down in terms of economics.
Yeah.
Because if you can get those much lighter materials to be very economic,
yeah,
then you're talking planes, trains, cars, everything, just a real explosion in what's feasible. Okay. Manufacturing renaissance. I've talked a lot about this on the Solaria report, so we don't need to dwell on it. But between the drops in the cost of energy and improvements in robotics and fabrication technology, you know, it does look like we're seeing an improvement in the economics of doing manufacturing in the developed world versus the emerging markets. And of course, bringing that technology to a smaller footprint so smaller businesses can be much more effective.
Yeah.
Is there anything you wanted to say? Because you and I have certainly watched the 3D printers bob around in the markets.
Yeah, I have really nothing to input there. I think that, you know, those have been the wunderkind of for me for that renaissance, and they're still in their infancy, and who knows where it's going to go. But that's, you know, one good example of what we're talking about.
And we would have seen robotics companies do IPOs, except Google bought them all. That's one thing, you know, between the private equity guys sort of scarfing things up or the big guys buying them, the IPO market with the new technology has been much thinner than I had expected. Yeah. So that's been a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, last section I talked about sort of the life technologies. And it's fair to say the one thing I wanted to mention was biotech has just been the darling of the markets.
Yep.
There's no doubt about it.
Yep. And, you know, that is the, you know, back in the 80s, it was, you know, computers and semiconductors. And this decade, it's going to be biotechnology. And, you know, we're in our infancy. Oh, I won't say infancy, but we're in the early stages. I'll say, and if it's a 10 step process, we're in step two or four, so between two and four, I would think. And this is a long, long way to go.
Well, it's funny because I, you know, I'll dive in and look at what these companies are doing and, you know, I'll dive in and say, oh my God, isn't this wonderful? This is just so wonderful. And then you dive in and say, oh my God, this is the most frightening thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, exactly. Not only that, I mean, you look at, you know, the number of companies that are out there doing something and the number of companies that could actually just blow up and go to nothing. This is one of those places where you want to be tread very carefully and make sure that, you know, your exposure is more broad-based than trying to hit a home run picking an individual company.
Right. So this is another place to hide behind the experts.
Yep.
Is what I think. Yeah. Okay, well, that's it for trends. So hopefully that helps you see a little bit more of the shift as it's going on within the equity markets, just by seeing some of the examples. Let's turn and talk about risks. I have to laugh. I was on the Council on Foreign Relations website and reading what the establishment had to say about the shift to 3.0. And they had a book they recommended on risks. And it's a professor who studies risks, and he has made a collection of all the risks in the world and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so I fell for it. I went and got his book. And it covered all the risks, Chuck, in the 20th century. And I realized after this unbelievably academic, statistical drilling and, you know, blah, 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 it's the same risks that in the 21st century. Nothing has changed. It's the same thing. Anyway, so let's talk about... I sort of identified five big risks, and as it was in the 20th century, it is in the 21st century. So let's talk about war. What does war mean to the equity markets?
Well, we have a chart number 7, I think, here that's a good reference point. And typically what you see, and this is, again, who knows what it's going to be in the future, but if you look at past wars, what happened is you have a fear that is created when a war breaks out. And you tend to see the equity markets take a big hit. And at the same time, normally you see, and we weren't talking about this, but you also tend to see the gold market take off at that point in time. And then once, you know, not even necessarily when the war is over, you start to see the equity markets start to pick back up and risk is back on again. Because, you know, it's more of a fear as to where it's going to go and what it's going to turn into, and then the markets tend to accept that and get adjusted to it, and then you start to see a correction. So from an equity standpoint, I would expect to see a decline in prices and then a flattening out, unless it's a world war, of course, and then a flattening out and, you know, a rise again, because, you know, you always laugh when we talk about this, but it is, you know, it does create jobs and it does create demand.
Right. You know, it's interesting, if you look at this chart, the war periods look very much like the chart we showed under the dividends matter discussion.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, it's markets going sideways, and this is when you want to be buying dividends.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Okay, this is the nuclear and other environmental disasters.
let's take a look for, you know, I don't have a nuclear disaster here, although I could have gotten one maybe from the Russian. But let's take a look at what happened on the BP oil spill. And what you'll notice on this chart, this is chart number 8, I believe, BP prior to the oil spill was at, you know, almost $50. And within a couple of months, it was down to 22.
Right.
And
that was a very painful dive.
It was a very, and I remember, you know, at that point in time, not, you know, I didn't like BP, but I'm always looking for opportunities. It's kind of like, you know, our always discussion on the commodities or on the emerging markets. When this was, you know, I can just remember so vividly that the market was, you know, BP's done. That's it. That's the end of it. They just, they're not going to survive. And lo and behold, they're back up to higher prices, or were higher prices than before the spill.
Right. Although I will say in this one, I don't know what the politics were behind the scenes, but this was a time when you thought, okay, this is dangerous. You know, this company really could go lower or even be bought at, you know, my fear was not that they go under. My fear was somebody picks them up for a song in a politically arranged marriage and the shareholders lose. Yeah. And so that was my big concern, but this is exactly the moment that value investors look for if you're in a position to take that kind of risk. But obviously that was a perfect example how, you know, if you have a concentration in one stock, the unexpected can happen. You never know.
That's right. And unfortunately, during that decline, if you look at that, whatever, that 3-month period there, human emotion messes with people, and you know, we can step back and say, well, you know, hindsight is 20/20 if we would have just hung on, but the emotion drives you. You know, here 3 months earlier you were at $50 and now you're at $20 and you've lost 60% of your value how big of a position. People have a tendency to, that's the time when they panic and they tend to get out. And that's why, again, I'm not professing this, but you tend to, if you're an emotional person, emotions are about 70% of investing. And if you can't do those emotions, you really should be looking for a little help there.
Well, but here's the thing, not emotion. If you have, 'cause I faced this situation at the time, if you know somebody who's got, too much in that one stock and they've taken that much of a loss, they could take more. You can't afford to bet the ranch on anything, is absolutely my feeling. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Integrity of digital and power systems. We're certainly seeing this come up more and more these days.
Yeah. So what I did was I tried to find, a recent example of what happened to a stock that got hit by, you know, one of these break-ins. And the first one that came to mind was Target. And if you look at, here's a chart of Target that we can see is chart number 9. And you can see that really it was almost, the market yawned. You know, it went from 62 down to 55-ish, and the market just said, big deal almost. And I find this was a complete surprise to me. Look at what happened to Home Depot. It was Home Depot, I believe. I don't have the chart here, but the market didn't even lose, I think, 2 or 3%.
Right.
I don't know if that's because investors don't look at that as a risk to the company, or because really the company isn't so much at risk. It's really the people whose data was stolen.
Right.
That's you and I.
Well, I think the market knows that these things happen, and it can happen to anybody, and they think that, you know, the company, this is really assessment of the management's ability to deal effectively with it.
That's true.
And what they're saying is Target is going to figure it out.
Yeah. So, you know, I was, you know, my immediate thought is that maybe it's just they've become so complacent and acceptant of the fact that nobody's data in reality is safe anymore anyway. So it's just big deal. Next.
Well, the other possibility is the guys who engineered it were busy buying.
That could be.
Okay. So natural disasters, Fukushima is our example.
Yeah. So if we take a look at the Fukushima chart, what I did was I grabbed the global uranium ETF, and this is a basket of uranium stocks, and you could see what happened. That was in 2011, in March of 2011, and at that point in time, it was hovering around $60 a share. And within, you know, on the day that it happened and within a week, it had almost been cut in half. And since then, you can see the decline. Now, is that reflective, that decline since then, is that reflective of the fact that, you know, the world's distaste and desire for, you know, nuclear energy? Or is this
commodities and energy coming down?
Commodities and energy, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, which is that? But, you know, here's another example of making sure that you're not overly concentrated in any one thing.
Right. Well, think about it. You're going from 65 down to below 12 or 12 and a half. That's a pretty big drop.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big drop. But it's, I think when you look at these examples, what you realize is anything can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you have to be prepared for that. And I think you have to, if you're an investor, you have to have your portfolio or your investment set up such that if that happens, I can't get wiped out. I really, you know, I'm going to take a hit, but it's not going to affect me, because you can't hide. That's just a part and parcel to investing. Things happen and you got to be able to deal with them. And the best way to do that is to manage your risk by making sure your position size is correct.
Right. And so the last risk I had was what I call creative destruction, including unemployment. And that is, you know, when new technology comes in, and, you know, actually it may not be new technology. You do a very good job, Chuck, of pointing out sometimes it's simply, you know, technology we've had for many decades getting economic and more people learning how to use it, like CAD software.
Yeah.
So, or it's the integration of a new technology with lots of old technologies, which are getting cheaper, easier, and they sort of hit a tipping point together and boom, you're off and running. So,
yeah.
But I think we're seeing a lot of creative destruction going on, and the mobile smartphone integration is really driving a lot of it. And I've been astonished talking to people who manage advertising, and the shift from print to mobile phones and social media is just, you know, whoosh, it's been very fast. And so there's a lot of creative destruction going on, and that can be very bad for the equity market if you're not watching. So
yeah,
if you're in Sears, go ahead.
No, I was just saying it's not even just that. It's also, you know, you might be watching it, but how the market, what I found out through, you know, many, many years of getting the wrong side of the market, I've found things that, while you see it happening, you think the market's going to do one thing and it does just the opposite.
Right. Well, one thing I would say is I find the equity markets to be unbelievably informative. So if I try and understand what's happening in the economy without watching the markets, for example, I would never have understood sort of what's happening with social media without watching the equity markets.
Right.
And watching it from the equity market's point of view, not just the social media companies and those stocks, but the different stocks that were sort of interacting with the phenomena. And I just think it sends a different message, and it's part of the message. If you want to see what's going on, it's one of the messages you need to keep an eye on. And so I think the equity markets are an early place to watch that creative destruction, and it's important to watch them. As you would say, price matters.
It does. That's all that matters.
I don't think it's all that matters, but I think it matters a lot. Okay, strategies. So we've talked about what the trends are, and we've given some different examples to make sure you sort of see how they show up in the equity markets. We've talked about the risks and the things, all the things that can go wrong. So let's now talk about the strategies. What are the things you need to do in approaching this kind of world? And I think the first one that we really need to talk about is this question of buy and hold. For many years, people like me were, you know, first we're trained, you get on the internet and, or you get the books and everybody says you buy and you hold. You don't move around, you just stick with it. So here's the question, Chuck. In a world that is this uncertain and where it's so hard to know and understand what's going on, do we want to buy and hold or do we want to do something else?
Well, you know, I come at this from a real biased standpoint. I was like you. I was trained that buy and hold was the way, and I was trained by Wall Street. And Wall Street really has an advantage. That's what they want. They want you to buy homes. They don't want you to sell. They, you know, this is how they make their money. If you sell and you move out of their investments, they're not making money. So, you know, that being said, you know, that's not really the motivation. The fact is that we're in a situation where the world has changed, and if we were left to have real markets that were allowed to correct and do what real markets were allowed to do and not have intervention or assistance by government entities, then, you know, then I would say that maybe buy and hold is okay. I don't know. But all I know is that we are going through cycles, and you just start in the year 2000, we go through, you know, boom bust cycles. And what you can't do as an investor, and maybe you can if you're 20 years old, you can't go through many boom bust cycles because you don't know when the next bust cycle is going to be. If you happen to be ready for retirement and you go through a bust cycle and your retirement's blown out of the water.
Right.
So I'm just a firm believer that buy and hold, you know, am I smarter than the market? No, I'm not. But what I can do is I can say that there are times when you want to take less risk, and those are, you know, what methodology you use to be able to determine that, that really is left up to the individual investor. But I do know that the markets, you can be smarter than the market from a standpoint of watching yourself and making sure you don't have those huge, participating in those huge bust cycles. So I'm not advocating that anybody can time the market, but what I am advocating is that you can miss major corrections, and that's what you should be looking to do. And one of the first charts that I wanted to just present, I think the last Solari report, I presented a way to be able to avoid those boom bust cycles by a simple methodology on moving average crossovers. I don't have it here, but this is another one, and this is just a ratio chart of the S&P 500 against the 30-year Treasury bond. So if you had a really confined world, and you could say you can only invest in two things. You could either invest in stocks or you can invest in bonds. And what you want to do is you want to be invested in stocks when that ratio trend is moving upwards, and when it's moving downwards, you want to be invested in bonds. And if you look at what we have right here, we went through boom bust cycles. And while you're never going to be able to pick the tops or the bottoms, what you can do is avoid those major declines. And this is a real good starting point that I would recommend investors that should be looking at if they're concerned about going forward and they're not in a situation where they can take, you know, they need to have as much growth as they can, but they want to be able to sidestep a potential really major bear market. This is one methodology you can look at along with the moving average that we talked about on the last report.
Right. Well, it's time makes a big difference. I said to somebody the other day, you know, if I was going to Mars for 20 years, I'd put all my money in the emerging and frontier markets because I could get the best PE. And, you know, I'd come back in 20 years. But since I'm not going to Mars, I need to wait before I do that. So timing is everything.
Absolutely.
Okay. So,
so let's talk about just buy and hold.
Okay.
I think I have for the first chart, which would be chart number 12. This is a long-term historical chart of the Dow Jones Industrials. And what you can see, real simply, is it goes through periods of consolidations, which is your sideways trends, and then it goes through periods of growth. And those sideways trends are when you start to see the potential for those major corrections. Because if you look at the 68 through 81 period of time, if you had invested in 68, you would have had made no gains through the entire period if you had held it through 1981. So the stock market wasn't the best place to be. And so, you know, buy and hold is one of those times. If you're going to buy and hold, can you withstand those major drawdowns, which you're going to see in a consolidated market? And if you do, you're going to want to, you know, this is our mantra we've talked about since day one, is you're going to want to own dividend-paying stocks because while the stocks may go up and down, at least you're getting paid to hold on to them.
See, that's what I feel, and that's one of my biases. I would much rather get a 3 or 4% dividend in a stock that's going up and down than sit around and be debased in short-term treasuries. So, but I don't mind the up and down.
Yeah, and I think that's – I would too as long as – and I think investors, you know, as much as we could try and point them in that direction, a lot of investors can't stand the ups and downs part of it, and that's the real problem.
Right, right. Okay, so, buy and hold two.
Yeah, let's go on to the final one. So here's – this is just an example of what you have to experience if you're going to be a buy and holder. And it really matters on where you buy and what you have to live through. So if you look at the period, the first blue bar there, the Dow Jones dropped 34% in 2000 to the 2003 bottom.
Right.
Now, that was a major bear market. And the Fed stepped in and started not only lowering interest rates, but you know, printed money and did whatever fiscal and monetary policies they needed to do to get the economy going again. And if you look at how, you know, that was not really that quick of a decline because it took almost 3 years to complete that. Look at what happened subsequent to that in 2008.
Right.
It dropped 50%, and that happened in almost a little, depending upon where you pick the top and the bottom, it was a little bit over a year and a half. So we lost 50% in a year and a half. And those are the things that investors have to look at and say, do I want to live through that? Ultimately, you'd have been fine if you'd have just held on. But how many people needed that money from the time it took to hit the bottom to where it came back up to where they were even again?
Right. I think a lot of people just don't want to live through that.
Right. And so buy and hold to me is one of those things that it's a personal choice. And you can buy and you can hold and you can get opportunities. And if you live through them and if you're patient, most likely you're going to be whole again at some point in time in the future. But if you don't want to live through that, you know, you need to come up with an alternative strategy.
Right. So part of this is personal taste.
Absolutely.
But I think
there's not one right answer here for anybody.
Right. But I think it's before you start to invest or as you're investing, you need to be very clear about what your strategy is in terms of buy and hold versus trying to modify it if you're going to modify it.
You know, Catherine, I don't want to take too much more time. I just want to make one additional point there, and that is that what I found is that where it really runs into a problem is if investors, they think they can live through it. And then what happens is once you're in the middle of it, their emotions grab a hold of them and say, you know what, I've changed my mind. And normally the way that works out is it's, you know, close to a bottom at that point in time. And so you need to make that determination before you invest, not while you're in the middle of it, because the emotions will drive you to make the worst investment decisions. And so you're absolutely right that it should be determined and it should be thought of ahead of time and you have a plan before you actually put a dollar to work.
Right. Well, and it's very interesting. We saw that when precious metals came down, we saw that, you know, is really having to say, look, you know, here's my line in the sand. I'm out.
Yep.
And one of the things that it was very important for me to be able to do is persuade someone, look, we can always buy back in. You know, if it turns up, we can always buy back in, but we don't. One of my favorite preachers says, my elevator only goes to the first floor. If you want to get to the basement, you know, you can, I'm getting off. You can go down to the basement without me. So anyway, let's talk about what matters. Okay. So the first thing I want to talk about, and this is my, you know, sort of my big bias. I think the future is built by the people who build it. You know, and investment first and foremost is about what you're for. And I think, you know, the history of investment says the people who are in it are the ones who benefit from it. And they're the ones that build the future. And I think there will be a future. And there's been, you know, we've been through a period of very dramatic change and in some ways very off-putting developments from the leadership. And, you know, there are more than a few investors, Chuck, who are shell-shocked. But, you know, that's the nature of change. And it's very important to sit down, take a deep breath and say, okay, what am I for? What do I think is going to do well in the future that I want to be for? Yeah. Because that's where wealth gets created. Wealth doesn't get created by being against things. It gets created by being for things.
Yeah.
And to me, there's a tremendous amount going on in this world that's worthy of being for. And I think that's really what investment's about. It's about, you know, what am I going to bet on? And what's the future I want to see happen? And what's the future I believe in? And, you know, ultimately, especially as more and more gets happening through privatized vehicles, you know, the vote that we have that counts is where we get up and bet with our time and our money every day. So I think the future is going to happen whether you're there or not. But if you want to be part of it, this is part of getting in and being part of it. So I just want to make a pitch to be part of the future. And I think, you know, I think the potential for the equity markets to grow in terms of what's represented in the equity markets and the importance of the equity markets to determining what happens on this planet is just going to grow. So my attitude is, you know, the water's choppy, come on in.
Well, that the other thing that you do a really good job, and you it always makes me smile when you say it, so I would hope you say it again because it's really relevant here, is say what you say when about 7 billion people have to get up every morning and go do
that. Right. It's Chuck Lorre's comment on the slow burn. You know, 7 billion people get up, and the way they pay their rent and the way they eat is, you know, doing something of value to somebody else.
Yep.
And being of service. And that's the great, powerful urge that's going on around this planet. And as we securitize more and more assets and more companies into the markets, you know, that momentum of 7 billion people trying to make it work is what's going to be reflected in the market. And to a certain extent, you know, that's why I found it so fascinating to look at the Alibaba IPO, because, you know, Jack Ma has found a way to get millions of little businesses, you know, online and doing business on the internet. And it's a very fascinating model of that urge of, you know, hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs trying to figure out a way to make a living. It's kind of a remarkable thing to watch.
Yep.
Okay, custodian, I have to beat the drum. I'll never forget when somebody was one commentator was complaining that he'd lost money because his securities were custodian at a firm run by a former Goldman Sachs chairman. And my comment was, why in the world was he leaving his securities at such? Yeah, I mean, what did you expect? Anyway, so to me, it's very, very important where your securities are custodian. And I think, you know, the Madoffs of this world happen, and the there are companies that don't make it that go down. And so you want to be very, very careful about where your securities really are and who's got the custodian on it. And this is one where you don't want to be creative. You want to be pretty conservative about this. So I think that's something a lot of investors don't think about, and it's important to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly true. I mean, that's another thing that's in line with, you know, trying to look for yield. You go out and take additional risk that you're going to get some incremental small amount of, you know, yield greater than what you get, but the risk that you take is really not worth it. And so I find that same story is true for custodians.
I was laughing my head off today. I sent it to you. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it. There was a new survey of millennials and asking them where they like to bank. And 71%, the preference was community banks. The next preference was local credit unions. And down, you know, at the very bottom at 41% was online banks. So they've figured the custodian part out, at least as with respect to their bank deposits. So I thought that was pretty funny.
Good for them.
Okay, price matters. Now I'm going to invite you to talk about this because this is one that you feel strongly about.
Yeah, you know, but the thing is, Catherine, it took, you know, I can just relate back to the story that when I first started really looking at price, I was getting coached by somebody and, you know, they kept saying that and I was so frustrated. I just quit saying that stupid statement. What does it mean? And ultimately, the sledgehammer hit me over the head and I finally got it. And if it's something, you know, I'm going to keep preaching it because at some point in time, hopefully people are a lot smarter than I am and I'll get it sooner. But frankly, what price matters means is that you may have a bias. You may think you know what's going to happen next. You may have, you know, I know gold is going to go to $2,000 an ounce. Well, you know, it might. But if it's going down to $1,100 first, do you want to still own it? The fact of the matter is if you follow price, that is really the most important thing because the rest of the news is just nothing but noise. Because there are very few people in this world, and there's a website that will, you know, back up what I'm saying here, that are good at predicting the future, and most people are worse than the flipping of a coin.
Right.
So if you're trying to get ahead of the crowd, you're not going to be able to do it. Just accept the fact that the best you can do is to follow price because price will tell you if gold's going to go higher, then price should go higher. If it's going down, don't fight it. Go with the trend. And so for me, it's trend following, follow the things that are going up and get out of the way of the things that are going down.
Or certainly pay attention, you know, because I'm somebody who really believes in aligning with the primary trend. But, you know, price tells me if I'm wrong, because if I think the primary trend is up, but the price is going down, you know, that is a very important signal. I need to pay attention.
Yep.
Leadership. I'll take this one because this is one I care very much about.
Yep.
I think it is unbelievably important, the quality of the people who are governing or managing whatever the thing is you're investing in, whether it's a company or a fund or an ETF. And as you know, I pay a lot of attention to looking at the leadership. It's interesting. We looked at the BP or Target, you know, different companies that had events happen, unexpected things, terrible things. You know, that's where it really matters, the quality of the leadership that you have on the board, the quality of the lead investors, the quality of the management. Leadership really matters, particularly when you get into the tight situations. Or, you know, just simply, as we said, you're going through a remarkable shift in the marketplace. Things can change overnight. Do you have leadership that can spin on a dime, change, lead, you know, do what has to be done? So to me, I overweight the importance of leadership. I look at leadership, you know, I will not put money. I mean, this is leadership really counts when you're custodian. If the former chairman of Goldman Sachs suddenly takes over the firm that's your custodian, you know, you got to be nuts. Well, you know, before when the economy was good and you could trust the government to watch out for everything and to enforce check, nobody thought about this. You know, nobody cared. Their attitude was, it's insured, I'm okay, it's not a problem. Now it matters. You know, we're back to old-timey rules here. So leadership really counts. Diversification. You have two charts on diversification, which I thought were fascinating. Why don't you describe this to us?
Okay, so I'm going to weave in this little the discussion on diversification, but also talk about price real quick. So if you look at pre-2008, before the market took, you know, its correction in 2008, here's the chart of the S&P 500, which is in red. You've got the Euro-Pacific, basically Asia, in green. You have the European stocks, which is in pink, and then you've got the emerging markets in blue. And this is in an upward market. Diversification matters a lot because if you'd have just stuck all your money in the S&P 500 in this case, you would have done okay. You would have done fine, but you would have done much better off by a factor of, you know, almost five times if you'd have had your money in the emerging market or at least some exposure. So again, this is where following price matters. You would have, if you'd have just focused on saying, I'm going to be in the S&P and price is going up, that's great, but you missed out on a massive amount of gains. So price matters, but diversification matters just as much in an upward market. Let's take a look at a downward market, which is the next chart, which is the post 2008. And what you should come out away from this is that diversification doesn't matter in a downward market. When things go down, everything goes down together. So all risk assets in 2008 went down together, and you got very little variability from, you know, any kind of difference from how much was lost, because most of them lost, you know, 50% plus or minus a little bit. So what you should take away from this is diversification matters in an up market, and diversification doesn't matter in a down market. So so that's why I go back to buy and hold is not necessarily, because you could diversify away a lot of risk by, if you're going to be a buy and holder, but in a down market, in a severe down market, you can't.
Right.
And now go back to dividends, because I know that's one of the things that you just absolutely are in favor of.
Yep. Dividends matter.
They do. And let's take a look at chart number 16, which I think is my last chart. So this is a chart of the S&P since 1988. And the green area is what you would have gotten from price appreciation. And the blue area is the part that you get from dividends. And what you can see is since 1988, dividends have represented 40% of your total returns.
40%. That's tremendous. Right.
Yeah, it's a huge amount. So over the long haul, dividends really do matter, and they especially matter, as we pointed out in some of the other areas, when you're going through a sideways consolidative period.
Right. Right.
I should point out, we did a great equity overview on dividends matter. You can find it in the equity library, and it's really worth listening to. Okay, let's just talk briefly about value strategy, Chuck. If you could explain what a value strategy is and why it's important to consider having that as part of your strategy.
Sure. You know, over the long run, what you have is, you know, there's been numerous studies that value is a long-term outperformer than any other type of strategy, whether it's growth or momentum. There's all kinds of, you know, various and sundry types of other investment strategies. But value, value over time is the most beneficial from a return standpoint. And so what you're looking for, whether it be sectors or regions or companies, individual companies, you really want to find those companies that are undervalued. And now there's not one methodology that defines what undervalued is, but a lot of people, for example, might use price-to-book ratio. Finding a company that is lower price to book against their peers, or a country that has a P/E ratio that is at 15 while the United States is at 25. We know that you get reversions to the mean. And what people, good, smart investors do is that people put money in things that are undervalued, and they eventually catch on, and then they grow and they become overvalued, and they take that money out of an overvalued area and put it into undervalued. That's just buying. It's kind of the concept of buying low and selling high.
Right. I kind of call it putting money in uncool companies, because you watch the pricing. You know, we've certainly seen this on a company like Tesla. You know, sometimes I think that people are just angry that innovation has been slow in certain ways, and so they said, I don't care. I don't care what the price earning is. I'm just going to buy Tesla as a protest vote. It's my way of turning to Detroit and saying, you know, go jump in a lake. I've had it with you guys. So I don't care what the price is. I'm just voting for this because it's a protest vote. And, you know, so you get this situation where a company's considered to be very cool, and you look at the prices, and it's hard to make economic sense out of the whole thing. But you look at the corollary, which is, you know, something that everybody thinks is uncool. It's buggy whips. It's not cool. And it's way underpriced relative to, you know, the cash flows and what the real opportunities are. So it's sort of buying it when it's uncool, selling it when it starts to get cool again.
That one thing about the value strategy that investors have to consider is that value investing, you have to be patient, because
very
like emerging markets, you know, we know they're severely under, you know, they're maybe half the the value of the United States, so it makes them very, very attractive. But frankly, over the last 3 years, they've been really terrible investments. And if people
right.
aren't patient, at some point in time, that's going to change. So either you have to have a way to identify when they come out of their uncool state and be able to jump on board, or you have to be buy in and be very patient.
I put a link, it's up at the blog post, a link to the article at Guru Focus, Global Stock Market Valuations and Expected Future Returns, which I think does a really good job of explaining.
Yeah, they do a great
job. That phenomena as it is now, because although I will say, you know, you and I were talking about that one study where they recommended after a year, if it hasn't moved up at all,
yeah,
you know, maybe it's not a value stock, maybe it's just a dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, last thing I wanted to mention was really we've talked about buy and hold, we talked about sort of some of the things that matter. I think a very important part of your strategy is what I would call lifelong learning. You know, I really encourage the subscribers to put something in their, you know, in their time budget to regularly go at learning about, sort of educating themselves in investing and working on their financial matters steadily, because I think the discipline of investing in that education and that intention really pays off. But I know it's something you do a lot of, Chuck, and maybe you could say just a few words about it.
Well, part of it was because for me, it was forced to, when you have, you know, certain credentials, they force you to keep them up to date. And so, you know, I don't want to say it was, you know, I'm trying to make myself better, because it was really, I was out of an obligation to, you know, maintaining my credentials. But what I found was is that, you know, the investment world is changing unbelievably fast. And just
right.
to see what has happened since the year 2000 to where we are today, we've gone through two boom bust cycles and potentially into a third one here. And, you know, what has changed is that all the corollaries, all the things that we thought should happen, that we were trained that from historical perspective, maybe not relevant anymore. And so
right.
the only way that you can keep up with that, if you're trying to, you know, trying to stay abreast of the markets and manage money, you've got to be able to recognize those and keep up with the market. Because like technology, if you don't keep up, it's going to pass you by. And, you know, that's not really healthy normally for a portfolio.
Well, there's something else. You're also, not only are you doing, you know, it's like gardening, what you pay attention to grows. So not only are you helping to grow your financial wealth, but I think it's a window on the world. I do think with this process of securitization, we're going through a process that's only going to happen once, and it's going to be a very, very big shift. And this really is a window on the world to a whole world economy that's changing in, you know, ways we don't even begin to understand. And, you know, you want to have a window onto that process. Because it's going to be, in some respects, it's going to be, we're going from many little psychic storms to one big psychic storm, and who knows what's going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I want a window on that world, and the way to do it is to sit down once a week and open the window and peer out and see what you see.
Yeah, you
okay, well,
close it right away because the storm's
coming.
You never know.
Ah! Okay, well, Chuck, this has been unbelievably informative. I thank you for all the work you've done on these slides. And we look forward to checking in with you when we see how the year ends. So until our big annual equity overview, you have a great quarter, okay?
Thank you. You do the same. It was great talking with you.